coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for Hey Kids Comics.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. I am Andrew. With me, in a particularly foul mood tonight, is the Jedi Cole Houston. Are you?
Yeah, I'm pretty vexed.
Are you turned up for something? I don't. What's going on over there?
I'm just in a particularly belligerent nature tonight because of the nature of our show tonight.
Yeah, we are doing a show tonight. What's the show about, since you're real upset about
this? This is about... You want to know what this is about? You want to know.
I would like to know what this show is about.
You would like to know.
I bet you
would like to know. Well, let me tell you.
As the host of the show.
That's right. I bet you'd like to know what you're going to talk about tonight. Well, what you're going to talk about tonight... is anger. Talk about the burning rage inside.
The burning rage. Now you're sliding into Nick Cage. The burning rage inside.
Neighbor. What you're gonna see here is a kind of Pabst Blue Ribbon level of Frank angry when my woman is being annoyed by some punk college kid who thinks he knows something.
When's the last time you saw Blue Velvet?
It seems like just yesterday,
because I don't know if you've seen the...
I think I missed out on my chance to see Blue Velvet on the big screen at the Alamo Draft House, or the Texas Theater, one of the two. I forget which had it, which makes me further angry.
Which just feeds that anger.
No, I just want to grab a Roy Orbison cassette.
Cassette.
To my homies and just cry out, Candy Color Clown.
Jesus, but yeah, okay. So tonight's show...
Guess what? Fight scenes to the tune of really good music didn't start with Guardians of the Galaxy. It started with Blue Velvet, neighbor!
Right, it didn't start with Tarantino or James Gunn. Yeah, so tonight we're talking about anger. Angry comic book characters, why they're angry. The angrier, the better.
Damn it! How dare you tread on my line!
It's going to be a long night, folks. Buckle in. Tip your waiters.
I'm really trying to channel some anger.
You're doing a good job. I only...
I'm over the map now. I'm starting to go into some Nicholson.
Sort of a
Jack Nicholson, Lewis Black.
You've definitely pushed off of the Huckleberry Finn shore of Dennis Hopper and fed right into the giant Mississippi of Jack Nicholson. Just... So yes, Cole, where did the idea for this show come from?
How the hell should I know?
I think we now know where the idea came from.
Yeah, I think I like stubbed my toe or something. So I was like, angry comics.
Cole has unplumbed depths of rage, just reservoirs of anger.
Yes, yeah. This is actually going to be rather cathartic for me.
Because I don't think I've ever seen you actually, I've seen you like perturbed and off-put by whatever situation it is, but I don't think I've ever seen you actually angry.
God damn it.
What do you think leads to an angry... Okay, so let's handle the giant green elephant in the room first, right?
No, really. Seriously, fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate.
God, wrong show. Wrong show.
Oh, damn it!
Hate leads to ice cream. Ice cream leads to thighs. Thighs leads to anger. It's cyclical. Cyclical.
Yeah, it's a vicious circle. And speaking of vicious, yeah. Absolutely. We're going to devote in fact, I think the title of the show is something like A Rainbow of Hulks.
Right. I think it's Taste the Painbow. That's the subtitle.
Taste the Painbow.
Taste the Painbow.
But yeah, there's a whole palette of Hulks. So we're going to go ahead and get the Hulk out of the way because everybody's, you know, that's, oh, it's going to be a Hulk issue. Well, there's more anger in comics, Horatio, than just, and I'm speaking, of course, to Andy's apocryphal son, Horatio.
I have him, yes. Horatio is on sits on Cole's knee and in the apocalyptic wasteland. And
it's sort of like the end of Logan.
It really is.
Sent a shepherd Horatio up to Canada.
I hired Cole to shepherd Horatio to Canada, where I've set up a fine meats company.
That's right.
Gross. So yeah, you were saying. I'm sorry, I interrupted you with Horatio talk.
Yeah, the meat, the monkey meat factory.
The monkey meat factory, right? That's gross.
Okay, yeah, this is. We're going to talk about the Hulk first because the Hulk is the obvious go-to. And then we're going to kind of wind our way around some of the characters that have the angries, that have a case of the angries, that you're not necessarily – they're not the ones you're thinking of.
And even right if off. They, even if they are the ones you're thinking of, like in my – I really wanted to get into why these characters are angry. You know, what was the impetal reason when creating these characters that make them angry, right? Because everybody knows who the Hulk is. Yeah. Everybody knows that, you know, whether it be from the big screen to the printed page, the whole idea is the angrier the Hulk gets, the stronger he gets.
Yeah, but it's also, you know, you have that juxtaposition. I think one of the really brilliant things that was going on in a time when brilliant writers were brilliant because they didn't even realize they were, you know, stumbling upon these sort of brilliant tropes that would benefit really brilliant writers years later, decades later.
Yeah, the mathematical theorem almost of...
Yeah, it's just, you know, they didn't know what they were building. They were just building these wonderful things. And what you get with the Hulk is this great sort of intellectual Walter Mitty... then, you know, kind of lives out that secret life only in a very terribly destructive and rage-fueled way is this this furious and it was effectively a Jekyll and Hyde story
right
for the modern world.
So, but my question for you is, you know, and we tend to not dwell.
Take that, James Fenimore Cooper.
We tend to not dwell on
who wrote that, by the way. I couldn't remember. It was the only three-word name I could conjure out. That
but why did they ever explore? Because I'm not the biggest.
Anyway,
I'm not the biggest Hulk fan. I don't read a bunch of the Hulk standalone stuff. I've read, you know, Ensemble Hulk stuff and Avengers Hulk stuff, of course. But why was why was Bruce Banner so angry? Why is it just was it just an idea of a Jekyll and Hyde story at that part? There was not necessarily a reason. It was just the polar opposite of smart and docile.
Well, I think that was really I think at its core, you know, the thing about it is there's this wonderful innocence to a lot of the comics of that era because they were just there to be entertaining. And I think, you know, you could ascribe a lot to Stan Lee, but at its core, it was just a Jekyll and Hyde story. It didn't need, it would be decades before it got Peter David. And somebody had to explore, you know, that rage had to come. The modern reader demanded an origin story, not of the Hulk, but of the rage that the Hulk represents, where I think Lee was content with it just being that dichotomy.
Okay, I'm with that.
You know, that all men have rage built inside of them, and every character I wrote was something about some apocryphal story about a woman I loved in color, in the mall rats.
I'm waiting for Eddie to zip line down from the ceiling and start screaming about Stan Lee.
Oh yeah, how dare you!
So there were a whole bunch of
his name.
Of Hulk variations, from the Red Hulk, which was actually General Thunderbolt Ross through an experiment, to the original Gray Hulk into the Green Hulk. Then there was Smart Green Hulk, and then there was my personal favorite Hulk, which I think definitely for me epitomizes the rage issue with the Hulk, and that is the Magic Mike of Marvel Comics. Mr. Fix-It.
Mr. Fix-It. I had a feeling you were going there.
White gloves and tight pants and a tie with no shirt on. Just...
You almost want to see that become invoked somewhere in the Marvel movie franchises. Because if for nothing else, ZZ Top would get a cut of Sharp Dressed Man being the theme song.
I see a lot of ladies in here tonight that could get gamma poisoning.
That's right.
All right.
Is there any oncologist in the audience? Because a lot of people are going to get radiation.
They say it's illegal for me to bring this level of gamma radiation in here tonight, but luckily for me, I see a lot of lawbreakers out there.
It's not only gamma rays are the only thing radiating all this body.
Oh, God. Ugh. But yeah, this was not a Bruce Banner level smart Hulk.
Meanwhile, all the ladies in the audience are dropping eggs like that, the hens and the...
Just dropping...
Chicken rooster cartoon.
Just dropping glass grapes like you tripped over the shag carpeting in 1976.
It's hard to get your footing in a place like that. Those macroscopic cells everywhere.
Just rolling around. Buster Keaton style.
Like, spilled a bag of BBs.
Damn it. God damn it. But yeah, cause this
gotta piss somebody off.
There was super like animalistic Hulk was super strong and basically was like, you know, spoke broken English, had that Frankenstein quality where he just, you know, that was Big Green. This wasn't that. This was Mr. Fix-It. If you don't know who Mr. Fix-It was, there was a period of time in the 80s and the late 80s, early 90s, I believe, where the Hulk...
This is what's often known as the Wolverine patch period.
Very, very nicely put, yes. Where he was a bouncer in Las Vegas. Where the Hulk was a bouncer in Las Vegas. Because apparently Marvel ran out of ideas.
Yeah, or someone at Marvel just watched Roadhouse.
And it was every day of this Hulk's life was like was almost like the quantum was like an episode of Quantum Leap. Because, you know, every day Bruce Banner would wake up and go, "Oh no, what did you do this time, Mr. Fix?" You know, like it was
you nutty Mr. Fix. It's the Mr. Fix-It show.
Right. So I loved that Peter David version of the Hulk because he wasn't Bruce Banner smart, he wasn't Green Hulk strong, but he was mean as shit and he was wily. Like that's what I loved. He fought dirty. Like it wasn't a matter of I'm just gonna lift a mountain and drop it on you because you're making me mad. It wasn't cover of Secret Wars. Which one was it? Number 8 or 9, where he's like holding up the entire mountain.
Yeah.
This was like I'll pull your hockey jersey over your head and punch you in the face, Hulk. Which was like the angriest. I think the angriest Hulk, because the other Hulk, I don't think he was animal. He was animal rage angry. This was like cognizant angry. Like I'm mad at you in particular, and I'm gonna beat the crap out of you.
Yeah, it's more focused.
Yeah. So what about you? What's your favorite Hulk, either scenario or favorite Hulk in general? Because there's a lot of Hulks. So
yeah, and the thing is, I actually enjoyed the Smart Hulk era.
Okay.
But it's sort of lacking in that kind of rage. He would still get pissed off at the odd person who rightfully pissed him off. But it kind of treaded in that best of both worlds because he was taking the best of. It was like, you know, it was essentially the brain of Banner in the body of the Hulk.
Right.
So it was sort of like the entire Master Blaster package.
All right, let's spend the rest of this issue talking about Master Blaster's package, can we? Because I would love that. Somebody call Stu. This is going to get good.
That's right. Which, ironically, the stuntman, Australian stuntman Angry Anderson, played Iron Bar in the very movie we're invoking.
Really?
There is a connection to Angry. Yeah, look it up. It's Angry Anderson as Iron Bar.
All right.
Apparently, yeah. So there you have it. Just grasping for straws here. But I think really, you know, the Hulk, I was just never a big fan of the Hulk, but I think that the character worked best when in the auspices of writers that knew how to do something with the character that was essentially you know, at its core, this is a character that's just like a mad bull escaped from the rodeo.
Right.
It has no focus or purpose. It just is. But occasionally, the Hulk calms down enough to know where to land his blows.
Sure.
And I guess for me, the best Hulk appearance was that kid show that the name of it escapes me, but where Stan Lee was a guest and the guy in the Hulk, they had this sort of revolving door on the set for guests to come and go. And they were, the idea was they had one of those guys in the bulky Hulk suits from the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
That they would go and do appearances, and he got stuck in the door.
What? No. Really?
Yeah, because this girl was, you know, got picked from the audience to come up and sit with Stan Lee, and he would create a superhero character. But what is something you like to eat? Chocolate chip cookies. Well, every time you eat chocolate chip cookies, you become Baroness Bumblebee. And it was this whole setup for what would you do if the Hulk arrived. And she goes, well, I'd just fly away. And he's like, he says, the Hulk can't fly. And it was sort of like, God bless you, Stan Lee. Nobody can jump very, very high. But apparently can't get through a damn revolving door on the set of a kid's talk show.
That's fair. Can I ask a question? Did the Hulk, because I haven't seen this. I know that it's probably available somewhere for us
I'm kind of curious now.
To be able to find it. But did the Hulk get angry when it was stuck in the revolving door?
Oh, it's hard to tell because, you know, being a costume, his it was just a sort of death mask grimace on his face, but he's sort of permanently that way. So.
That's awesome. So, yeah, I mean, but the one thing that the Hulk did do, if we're you know, pushing on past the Hulk at this point, is kind of set a bar for the angry comic book character. Whether it be the Mr. Fix-It, the Red Hulk, the Green Hulk, the Composite Hulk, the Blue Hulk, Pastel Hulk, Paisley Hulk, Fiesta Taco Hulk, whichever one. This, you know, it definitely set the bar for the angry character. And one thing I do want to talk about, since you did invoke Peter David, is angry is writing angry. In your opinion, as we get into this, I want to know who writes angry best.
Wow.
Because, I mean, we could always default to Alan Moore or Frank Miller. Those are throwaways. Like, yeah. You know they can do it. Alan Moore can write anything, and Frank Miller's made a career on writing angry. I'm the goddamn Batman, so that doesn't count for me. And I'm gonna jump in front of the train a little bit. Is Chris Claremont wrote angry as well as anyone else has ever written angry ever? And that's,
I think I'll have to give you that. He can do the angries pretty well.
Well, he does angry, but he also does, like, angst really well. You know, yeah. if you look at his stuff in X-Men, he does angst really well, and I think that translates to angry really well. Wasn't he the one that wrote the Kitty Pryde with her puffy ski jacket pointing back down the barrel of the camera and yelling, Professor X is a jerk? Wasn't that him?
Probably, because he has such a long history with that with that franchise, that, I mean, almost anything had to be, but yeah, that, forgotten about Professor X as a jerk. That probably was during his tenure, because it was a long tenure.
Right. So that for me, like,
I think also Marv Wolfman does it.
And I think it might be for the same reasons. You know, I think that it's because it was Claremont, by the way. It absolutely was Claremont. But I think Wolfman and I think Claremont write angry for the same reasons, and that is because a lot of their character base is based on an adolescent or post-adolescent cast.
Yeah.
So you have these young X-Men coming up after Giant Size, right? And then you have, with the exception of, you know, Wolverine, who is the angriest of all of them, yet the oldest, which we'll get into the Get Off My Lawn characters later. But on the other side, you have the Teen Titans, right? You have these young, hormonal, angst-driven, you know, and anybody who's ever had children or known, you know, had nephews or nieces knows how to identify that behavior. knows what it's like when you get pointed at by Kitty Pryde and yelled, "You're a jerk." It's like, all right, I can invoke that.
Well, and by that point, Professor X had already, you know, raised a whole generation of young
jerks.
Yeah, young jerks. Yeah, and you know, in the context of the X-Men especially, you have this constant, you know, there's a lot of bickering going on there, and in the Titans as well. So you have a couple of, where you're talking about groups, very tight-knit groups who kind of love each other, but they're also at odds. You know, there's a whole lot of anger issues there. And really, if you want to get into perhaps one of the less, you know, not really one of the ones you think about immediately, but sure, perhaps should, when it comes to anger issues, it's Bruce Wayne.
Okay.
I mean, he has basically made a career out of a singular anger issue.
A single unresolved moment in his life has led to his entire career, is what you're saying.
Pretty much. I mean, I think that it's like those 70s Tootsie Roll commercials where it was everything I think I see becomes a Tootsie Roll to me.
Yeah.
I think it's sort of like Batman, like, everything I think I see becomes Joe Chill to me.
See, I think you're right up to
it. Like, you know, Joker probably wasn't that bad to start with. Cut it out, Batman. Shit, I got chill pill. Chill! Chill! My parents took chill pills. They were called bullets.
That's right.
Too soon?
Have you watched this new cartoon? It's called Chilly Willy.
Oh, Martha!
Oh my shit! Good shit. No, you're right. I was avoiding Batman only because I didn't know how that would play in, because he's been an angry character, but then he's also been sort of a revelatory character with, you know, the Robins and love interests and things like that. So he definitely has had that anger period in his life, I think.
Well, also you have to understand that I think there are those anger issues occur in all of the best characters. But if you look at Batman, especially early on, a lot, there's this defining rage there.
Right. Okay. I'm with that.
And it becomes, you know, such a universal part of who he is. It's sort of like the mission statement, rage. What? That's not a mission statement.
Your core values up on your wall under your name at Wayne Enterprises is just Latin for rage three times. I don't think that works.
Well, you know, and then there's the inspirational poster down the Batcave. It's just a picture of Joe Chill. This is rage.
Right next to the cat says, "Hang in there."
Yeah.
That's
it was a gift. That poster was a gift from Catwoman, though.
Yeah, it was. It was. Damn it. Damn it. So what other? So yeah, Batman. I mean, he's up there with, I would say, with the Hulk as far as, you know, rage goes or anger goes. What? Who else falls into that category for you as far as like the poster child, the touchstone for rage, if you will?
So who are some of the more rage driven? I think one of them is none other than one of the Marine royalty.
Yeah, buddy.
Namor the Submariner.
He's so mad. Why is he so mad? I don't.
Well, you know, the thing about it is, this is, again, you have a character created by Stan Lee. Or co-created. I don't know, you know, to what level the involvement was, but a lot of these characters, other writers would come along. It seemed like the modern writer needed to find a way to justify everything. You know, it's like, I grew up with this character and some of it was kind of silly. So now that I have the reins, I'm going to explain why they were silly. And or what have you. And I invoke Peter David, who not only I believe, was he the one, or was it somebody else who decided that there had to be some sort of molestation in Banner's past or something like that?
I think it was David, because I think that was part of the whole Doc Samson thing.
Yeah, because that's – and then the other thing Peter David did in reference to the Hulk is another rage machine, the Rhino. David had to establish that the Rhino is a manic depressive.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that, but that's good to know for this issue. Like, Like that it's just it's not okay just to be angry anymore. You just can't.
Yeah, you have to have some catalyst, some underlying forces at work that are deep in your psyche. Otherwise, nobody knows what to do about it, apparently.
Otherwise, Doc Samson's out of a job, and we can't have that.
And you know, we talked before the show. You quite brilliantly had pointed out that the those who deal with the rage, like Doc Samson, who had, you know, gazed into the abyss.
Right.
Many a time with a lot of these characters, but also had the ability to go toe-to-toe with them if need be.
Well, that was, I think that's an important... We had a... Didn't we have a show? I know we did a show. God, we've done so many shows. about special...
Almost 250.
About special professions within the Marvel... or within comic books...
Well, we did a show on doctors in general, those who are actual or
right.
characters.
Which you have to, if you're going to heal superheroes, or I don't care what you're going to do, make their clothes, fix their cars, you have to have your own set of superpowers, or the Hulk is going to beat you senseless.
Yeah.
You know, or you're going to get the hem length of Madame Hydra's gown wrong, and she's going to have you killed. So you almost have to be able to have your own. There's some sort of weird cabal of superhero service industry members in order to, some union.
Yeah, you've got to be pretty well positioned not to get yourself killed in a lot of these situations. But the... John Byrne, of course, then had to explain why, had to come up with a plausible reason why Namor was sometimes friend and sometimes foe of the surface world.
Right.
And it was some sort of Vulcan blood fever or something. He basically had some sort of... I personally think one of the things that tends to get ignored repeatedly is that Namor isn't 100% anything. He's a 50-50 split between two species that should not be able to crossbreed.
Cole, you're wrong. He's a 50-50-50 split.
Oh, that's right.
Because he's half mutant. Atlantean, half human, and half mutant.
Half mutant.
He's 150% rage.
His tagline is actually 50% Atlantean, 50% human, 100% mutant.
That's right.
So I found a way to justify Namor being the first mutant. Oh. Just now. I've had a breakthrough.
Really? Wait, hold on. This is really important. If nothing else comes out of this issue, which so much already has.
Yes.
This has been a problem with Cole the entire time I've known Cole. Let alone prior to that. I mean, he has a story about when he and his life mate met. And, you know, referred to him as, what did she, as Aqua Spock?
Aqua Spock, yes.
I imagine it goes all the way back to that point.
Oh, it goes back to whatever point someone declared, and it was probably after Aqua Spock that someone declared Namor the first mute.
Okay.
But I think I just now
Let's hear
found
it. Lay
a
it
reconciliation.
On us.
He is the first mutation of a human, Homo sapien.
Mm-hmm.
And as well as the first mutation of the Atlanteans, Homo ichthyus.
Aqua sapiens.
Actually, I think would actually be Homo... crap, I lost it now. I think it actually technically would be Homo ichthyus.
You would know better than I do.
But it means fish boy.
Fish boy.
But I think that if you say that there were no mutants of any kind, that he sort of simultaneously was the first mutant of both camps. And then, of course, that begs the question, well, what Atlantean mutants? I think it's a pretty safe bet to call Atuma a mutant.
Yeah, I think so.
Because, you know, Krang or whatever the hell his name was, he didn't have any superpowers. He was just a badass.
Right.
But
yeah, he
Atuma
was
like Blue Hulk.
Right. You know, you're absolutely correct. Krang was like the Atlantean General Thunderbolt Ross.
Yeah.
And you're right, though. You had Atuma, and Atuma was not Atuma. I can't.
It's Atuma, not Atuma.
I can't do it. It's bad. So
it's all inflection.
I think I know why Namor was angry all the time. And it wasn't just that, you know,
oh,
he was...
like the Cher saw, he was a half-breed!
Yeah, well, he wasn't... It's not just because he was the douchebag in the Atlas ad at the back of the comic that Mr. Fantastic finally finally punches in the face in the last panel, and he doesn't get the girl.
That was that one where he comes up and kicks sand on Reed Richards.
Yeah, yeah.
Reed's like sees an ad in a magazine about becoming a
about going to space
particle physicist in space.
Right.
He gets mutated with cosmic rays and comes back and kicks his ass. Hero of the beach.
So we know that Namor.
Blow drop.
What? How fast does Namor swim?
He's probably a good 100 nautical miles an hour, maybe more.
Yeah, he's fast, right? Like that's the idea, is that he's really fast. So they say that he can spend, I forget what it is, like 25% of his time on the Earth's surface before he has to go back into water as part of his mutant ability, I guess. So my theory is that he constantly has the bends. Constantly.
Okay.
Because he swims to the surface at 100 nautical miles an hour, jumps up, punches Reed in the face, gets into a fight with somebody, hangs out with Dr. Doom, jumps back in the water, swims back to Atlantis at 100 nautical miles, hangs out, punches Atuma in the face, hangs out with Krang, runs around with
Namorita,
yeah, whoever, yeah. Polishes the serpent crown.
Well, I think the big problem is it's dietary.
Oh, okay, here we go. I like this.
There's a dietary element here. Because he 25% of the time he's eating good cooked food.
Okay.
75% of the time he's eating raw fish and crustaceans and
so you what you think it, is it is,
you know how hard it is to bring a good cooking temperature up at 50 fathoms?
That's true.
Ask real submariners.
Do you think
it's like literally the opposite of like going up in the mountains and trying to get your like freeze-dried lasagna that you're just anxious to eat but you can't get the water to boil.
Oh, because the elevation? Sure.
With a blowtorch. It works both directions.
So my question for you is this. How much of his anger is mercury poisoning?
Well, that's the madness that
why hasn't that ever been diagnosed for real? That would be perfect. That would be the perfect comic.
Yeah, it's so true because the volume of living 7 minutes ago fish that he consumes, you know, that were living while he was consuming them, of just, you know, seaborne fish that
right.
He is eating, he's going to be mad as a hatter with the
exactly.
Level he's ingested on a daily basis.
Well, I mean, he uses them as loofahs. He, you know, he oils his tennis rackets. That's not a thing you do. I don't know why that just popped into my head.
You do.
You oil your tennis rackets with fish.
In Atlantis, you have to...
Damn it. I don't know what's wrong with me. Oils his tennis rackets, Cole. Oils his tennis rackets.
No, but it works in a Namor context in a way it wouldn't work in, like, say, Peter Parker oiling his tennis rackets.
That's true.
Because then it becomes an Urban Dictionary thing.
I want to see that comic where... It would have to be written by, I don't even know, who would write it? The comic where Namor, it opens on Namor at the hospital, and he's being diagnosed with mercury poisoning, long-standing 70 years of mercury poisoning.
That's a very Starlin-esque.
Yeah, that's true. It would be, where it's like...
Starlin's the go-to for ascribing human conditions to non-human characters.
It's the death of Captain Marvel all over again.
Yeah, that's right. It's the death of Namor.
Where no one, where everyone tries to cure Namor of mercury poisoning and nobody can do it.
That's right, you know. He comes in with one of those big-ass magnets like they used to use to erase video cassettes.
Stark has built one using an arc reactor.
Yeah. It's like, no, you guys, it's basic physics. I don't think mercury really reacts to magnetic fields that same sort of way. But
I love the fact that we spent as much time talking about Namor as we have talking about the Hulk.
I know, and that's really not what we came here to talk about. But let's talk about some other really angry... I think there's a character that would be easy to overlook because we do tend, as is our way, to be very Marvel and DC-centric. Sometimes we'll hop over into Image and such like that. But I think there's a character that really, in a very Hulk-like way, only without the capital, you know, the destruction of property and
sure,
such, collateral damage... really epitomizes a sense of boundless rage, because from that is the wellspring of his power, and that's Mr. Furious.
Oh, nice. Even if it only manifests itself once.
Yes.
It's there. It's there. Right. No, that's good. I hadn't even put two and two together on that. That's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, because he is just a he embraces his rage, and from that rage it becomes, you know, his spirit animal is a sort of a badger, wolverine, and one of those, like, you know, blue jays guarding their nests.
To mean as shit blue jays.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, you're talking about a very angry character. Everything about his life centers around rage and anger, because otherwise he has no identity. And of course, you know, for the unindoctrinated, Mystery Men, the movie Mystery Men, is one of my favorite superhero movies ever. I think it's one of the best superhero movies ever made.
It's very good, yes.
Because it has an unwieldy cast and somehow tells a concise story in a way that Hollywood can't figure out how to do in a serious superhero film.
Right.
But that notwithstanding, a lot of people listening, and most people that I've ever talked to, don't realize that the origin of the Mystery Men, in a vastly different form, and for the most part, are from Flaming Carrot comics. It was sort of like the marketable side of Flaming Carrot.
Pseudo-marketable, let's yeah. be honest.
Well, I mean, they did have to change most everything because the Spleen's origins were considered too obscure since he got them from Swimming in Love Canal.
Yeah, that's a hard joke to get now.
Yeah. For those who weren't born in, like, 1957 through 1969, you don't know what the hell that even means, but, you know, gypsy flatulence curses are timeless.
They really are. They stand the test. Gypsy and, flatulent curses. That's good.
That's really what Stephen King's Thinner started out as. And somebody gave him a copy of Flaming Carrot, and he's like, damn it. What else would you... What
this
else
is too good. This is too good. If we're going outside of the superhero genre, you're absolutely right.
It started out as Squeaker, but then it's
just... Oh, no. If we're going outside, one of my personal favorites.
I throw you.
You broke me a little bit. You definitely broke me a little bit, because now I'm thinking about the movie. And I absolutely love the movie. One of my personal favorites is Warren Ellis wrote a book back in 1997. It started. It ran through 2002, and it was called Transmetropolitan.
And okay, yeah, I've heard of it, and I'm familiar with it. I can actually visualize the character.
Stars a character named Spider Jerusalem, and Spider Jerusalem was essentially kind of the future cyberpunk version of, like, a Hunter S. Thompson gonzo reporter that was that spent his life doing equal, you know, capital destruction, equal, you know, greater to or equal than, you know, uncovering political chicanery and you know, it was a really cool book. Think of it like the comic book version of Blade Runner meets Lewis Black. It was great, but the entire thing revolves around page after page, panel after panel, and page after page of just angry rants, just diatribetical, pointed soliloquy, you know, about political satire and social satire and you know, sci-fi. But like we've said about, you know, about Star Trek and everything else in the world, good sci-fi holds a mirror up to social issues and really, really pulls the sheet off of that dusty old couch. And this did that for sure. So if you get the chance to read Transmet and you haven't yet, so good. Like, it really embraces the idea that everything goes to shit in the future, that we really kind of descend into a stew of our own social mores and madness, to the point where there's, like, a chain of restaurants that's all based on Jeffrey Dahmer.
Oh, God.
there's that the sexual mores turn to Nazism. Like, all this weird stuff is happening in the future, and it revolves around this guy's career and, you know, like the unraveling of society and him shining a light on that in a totalitarian dystopian future. So, you know, no. Absolutely no through line to what we're going through today.
Completely.
But yeah, so read that, because it's friggin' great.
Character with considerable rage issues that occurred to me just now, and you're telling of that, he was a little off the normal page there, because he found himself in a world he never made, and that is Howard the Duck.
Nice. Nice.
Speaking of, you know, delving deeply into the into society with some biting social commentary.
Mm-hmm. No, you're absolutely right. So I need you to prepare yourself.
All right.
So I need you to step back from yourself. I need you to really put on. So if you don't know, if you haven't listened to, let's say, the Rant Corpette or some of the older issues or read anything that Cole's written, Cole does this thing called Jedi Cole Justifications. And the whole idea is that what was your greatest justification, Cole, that you've landed on? Because you've had some winners. Didn't you do one on Metachlorians at one point?
Yeah, I think that has to be my masterstroke, because that was the one justification. Some of them were just sort of passing fancy. Some of them were things that stuck in my craw, but nothing quite bothered me like the Metachlorians. And much as I reconciled, Namor's first mutant
justification, sure.
Yeah, just now, quite by accident. I found a way to reconcile, to make the midichlorians work within the confines, and that was the thing with Jedi justifications. The hard and fast rule was I had to back up everything with what was on screen,
right?
Which oftentimes, like when I found a justification for the purple lightsaber for Mace Windu, I found I could not. Yes. Read that aloud with fanboys, because, well, no, you have to understand it's a crystal. I'm like, no, it's that. Where were the crystals ever mentioned? They weren't. I'm going with what you see on screen. So in the case of the midichlorians, I found a way to make it work as looking at the Jedi as the ancient order they are. There are going to be factions. I mean, look at Catholicism. You've got all the, you've got, you know, your Jesuits and your Gregorian orders and all. You've always got your little factions and orders and stuff. And I think that there was an order that really needed to have some sort of scientific explanation for the Force, and found it in these organisms called midichlorians that just happened to be in greater numbers than those who had an affinity for the Force, i.e. those who might become Jedi.
Okay.
And then there are other factions who are like, that's great. Yes, you know, we acknowledge the presence of the midichlorians. They aren't necessarily the Force itself.
Right.
And I back that up with the fact that anytime Qui-Gon Jinn makes mention of midichlorians in Obi-Wan's presence, Ewan McGregor's about to roll his eyes at him.
Hey, that's true. That's true. Oh, okay. So here's the reason I brought that up. A while ago, Cole stumbled upon a realization that led to a justification of the worst supervillain in comic books, period. Who also, I've come to realize, might be the angriest person in comic books, period. And that is none other than J. Jonah Jameson.
Oh my gosh, I didn't even think along those lines.
So how much of his supervillainy? Because he is a supervillain. He had robots built to kill Spider-Man. You want to talk about fake news? The man coined that term.
How you surprised you were to discover? I think I just sort of out of the blue classified him as a supervillain, didn't I?
And I think it was Eddie and I were like, "Holy shit, you are absolutely right." But how much of that comes from what is inherently in him, and how much of that comes from a rage against Spider-Man? And really, he's in New York, right? So how many other superheroes and villains live in New York? Why is he so angry at Spider-Man, number one? And number two, why isn't he as angry at all the rest of what's happening? So that's my question to you, if you want to put on your sort of justification hat and run that down.
I think part of it is in the time of the Spider-Man arrives on the scene at the point where the Avengers have somehow made the Hulk okay enough for a while.
Okay.
With people, because, you know, he helped defeat Loki, and, you know, you have Captain America, you may as well just go after the Flag. So the Avengers come on the scene and they epitomize the disparate hero team up that sticks. You have the first family of superheroics come, the triumphant failed Rocket crew, who come back and are now, you know, become they're like the celebrity superhero.
Right.
And you have some other players in the field, but ultimately what you have with Spider-Man is he's sort of the first outlaw hero. He's a loner who comes in out of nowhere. And ultimately, I think he becomes initially, Jameson is kind of just playing the field, you know, using Spider-Man as this sort of scapegoat for everything wrong. This, it just, something gets stuck in Jameson's very, very conservative mind.
Okay.
That he has to rail against. And then I think that he was probably borderline on snap, and I don't know what the suicide rate is in editors-in-chief, but in major metropolitan newspapers, perhaps he saw a vision of the future where print media would become less and less relevant, and he could not live with that. There was ink in his veins. Who knows?
There was ink maybe in his veins.
Maybe Uatu the Watcher came down and accidentally showed him the future, and he snapped. But for whatever reason, I think there's a progression where the Spider-Man becomes this white whale, to the point where Jameson ceases to just be railing against him and wants to absolutely murder him, to the point of literally expending blood and treasure to that end.
Right, right.
I mean, the man probably had several million socked away in savings that he was just flushing down the toilet on spider slayers like some kind of wily coyote. Let that one sink in a minute.
Oh no, I got it. Yeah, it's there.
Yeah, it's you know, the Acme Spider Slayer collection.
The Acme Spider Slayer collection. Make sure you put my face on all of those little computer screens on the front of the...
That's right. Ought to be the Arnim Zola of publishing.
That's good. That was sort of my thing, right? Was like, he is by far, he's angrier than the Hulk is. Like,
there's nowhere for that rage to go. He can't turn. He wishes he could turn into some sort of multicolor, any color, you know, even just charcoal gray would be fine. But he doesn't turn into anything. So he has to project that out through, you know, missile launching tanks that can glide up and down walls.
Right. They can climb. They have spider legs and can glide up and down walls. Because when you hate something, you made something that you know, looks and acts just like the thing you hate.
Well, yeah, it becomes kind of like Carl from Caddyshack, you know.
That is the best analogy for him.
Who are your spider's friends? The daddy long legs.
That's the best. That is the best analogy for J. Jonah Jameson.
J. Jonah Spackler there.
So, okay.
Chameleon doing a cannonball. Cannonball coming.
If we're gonna talk about unhinged, angry comic book characters, and as we come up, you know, against the end of the show, we have to talk.
The worst part.
We have to talk about Watchmen. We have to talk about Rorschach if we're going
to
do it.
Before we get there, we do have to give a mention of the angriest, sort of the accidental hero, the desperation move during the crisis that gave us Guy Gardner as, you know, apparently the ring making its own decision.
Right.
On who is going to be the bearer of the power of the Green Lantern. During times of extreme crisis, the Guardians of the Universe just say, we'll just give it to this creep. So I understand that it's just hard to reconcile the choice. I understand they wanted to take the concept of someone wielding that power and put it in the hands of a loose cannon and you know, and it led to some great stuff, like the One Punch gun of Batman.
So good.
Everyone, it was just basically that's the only reason the character was created back in the Crisis, so eventually Batman could take him out with one punch. But, and then, of course, he becomes what? Warrior?
Oh, my God. Guy Gardner Warrior, where he was a cybernetic. He could make all the weapons out of his body.
Like, became sort of like the super-powered version of Ultimate Warrior from
God, I wrestling. Wish. From wrestling. But the thing was...
Wasn't there a Rourke movie called The Wrestler?
There was. It was Mickey Rourke and Michelle Leo. No.
It was the knock. It was like the knockoff. So Mickey Rourke's The Wrestler comes out, and you go to the dollar store, and there's this knockoff. It's like with cartoons. Every time a Disney movie comes out, you're like, oh, look, that's Polish Princess. It could be Moana or Marijuana, whatever the hell it's got. I don't care.
The Wrestler, starring Rob Schneider and... Asylum Pictures presents The Wrestler.
A week and a half, Nebraska, you know.
That's fantastic. No, but Rorschach. We're on Rorschach. Yeah, but no, Guy Gardner was never a bad guy. He was just a D-bag. Like, that was the thing. He was angry, but he was just a D... I don't think he ever went out of his way to be to do harm. He was just a douchebag, and nobody liked him. I think even Hal was like, and Hal got along with everybody almost, and he was like, no, you're a D-bag. And why don't you go open a bar called Warriors, you D-bag.
And then, of course, the Green Lantern connection, of course, to the angry Red Lanterns.
Yes, the blood spitting Red Lanterns, which then, you know, he became because he's so angry, and their power was rage. Apparently, that's an emotion that you can, you know, manifest and use.
Oddly enough, they didn't make the they're just kind of in the background there, but both Angry Anderson from Beyond Thunderdome and Mr. Furious are in the Red Lantern.
That would be that. Some Eddie, if you're listening, make that happen. All right, we got it. All right, we got to talk about Rorschach at least. We got to close this out with Rorschach. So, So, at what level does your rage and your angry just equal your crazy?
Well, I think this is another one of those cases of misdirected anger.
Okay.
A kind of misguided anger, because you get the distinct impression, and what I love about Watchmen is it's so chock full of history with its characters, but almost all of it's implicit. I think that's its brilliance, is because Moore can give you an implicit history that's just as rich as if you wasted everybody's time and money before Watchmen with trying to give a tremendous amount of backstory that was wrong. It's like going to see Star Wars in a way, because there's so much implicit history there that you don't have to have spoon fed to you, or completely misrepresented in that kind of bone claws way that the episodes 1 through 3 were.
Yeah, it's saga.
Yeah, exactly. So what you have with Rorschach is this sort of, you get the impression that he was once a very effective crime fighter.
Right.
If a crime fighter who's speaking mission statement was all equally misguided as to many others who were anger and rage. He's like Batman in many ways, is that he didn't even suffer a personal affront, but he's channeling everything about his upbringing, about this sort of I get the impression with Rorschach that with Kovacs, that in his youth he channeled a father he never had and developed a very stringent moral code because of his own upbringing, because of the environment he lived in. He began to develop this very rich fantasy kind of code and
this chivalry, this
way of... Yeah. Yeah, in the sense that, you know, all forms of wrong must be not only fought against, but must be defeated and trounced.
Right, can't be suffered.
Yeah, and you know, you cannot... There is no amount of failing to spare the rod that
will ever spoil the child.
Yeah, that, you know, the child, even the slightest, you know, you just have to go all in. And I think that that's the catalyst, that's the beginning of the boy that would grow to be the man who becomes Rorschach. So when he's confronted with a real or imagined or real but yet exaggerated situation that flies in the face of all that is good. He becomes, in many ways, this sort of ultimate misguided level of conservatism.
Right.
That's unflappable, that's unmovable. And he just becomes an agent of his own sense of right and wrong. And what's really ironic that just occurred to me is there's a wonderful line from Dr. Manhattan in a flashback where he's exploding the head of one of Moloch's henchmen. And he says, "The morality of my actions escapes me." And that works very well in the context of the waning humanity of this entity.
Right.
In that very Moore fashion, I think that Manhattan never was the person that this entity built itself around. That man was dead. But I think that you can apply the same to Rorschach.
Okay.
More from the sense of the immorality of his actions escapes him. In other words, in the staunch pursuit of his own moral code, his own sense of morality, his own sense of right, he can commit atrocities because they're committed in the name right.
Yeah.
And that unquenchable, unflappable, immovable sense of right is fueled by a deep personal rage that, you know, he's striking back at the world that abused him.
Yes, that took from him. And his answer, his ultimate answer to that is, in his mind, he's doing the world a favor by trying to set it right. So you're right. He's ignorant to his own immorality when it comes to his compass. His North Star isn't everybody else's North Star, but he can't see that. That's absolutely, that makes a lot of sense. All right, man, we gotta wrap it up. So why don't you final thought us and we'll get out of here.
All right, neighbor, you can write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com. Write us. I ask week after week, and you do not. I'm going to tweet out on Twitter, @JediCallYou.
Oh, God. How long can you keep this up? Can you keep going, or is this starting to hurt?
Maybe hurting you, but it doesn't hurt me in the least because it's who I am, damn it.
Jesus.
Interested in conventions in the Lone Star State, check out Convention Awareness Project Texas at cap-tx.info. Every convention in the state of Texas all year long. Keep it 100, Texas.
you're not saying man enough.
All right. If you're looking for me and Eddie Medina, the Rancor Pit, and catch us on the first and third Sundays of every month at watchonairlive.com, the Rancor Pit Live, and at the various stops this summer of the Rancor Pit Summer Invasion Roadshow Tour. I don't care that I got it wrong because I did it deliberately. It's a stalling act, neighbor. All right, man.
Neighbor.
If you're listening to this week today, we're going to be the Famous Monsters Convention in Dallas. Look for us there. With A101 Artist Alley and on stage Friday, Saturday, and Sunday with presentations and game shows. And with that, this is Angry Anderson Hopper.
Angry Anderson Hopper.
Damn it.
All right, that's enough. Join us next week for more Hey Kids Comics. We got a lot of stuff coming down the pike. We are scheduled out. Hey, Angry Anderson, how far are we scheduled out now?
All the way to 2020, man.
Until 20. Cole does this. This is our fountain of youth. This is our picture. As long as we schedule shows out, we have to keep doing the show. So this is our portrait of Dorian Gray.
Of Dorian Gray.
Damn it. You're just saying what I'm saying, only angrier. All right, everybody. Stay tuned till next week. Remember, buy, collect, and enjoy your comics. Just be really angry about it, apparently, and you'll be just fine. You got anything else to say there, Angry Anderson?
Be nice to each other.
Good night, everybody.